school and or weren't here. Just a quick recap of where we got to this morning. Deborah was the fourth judge of Israel, and after she came to become the judge of Israel, we're told that the land had peace for 40 years. But Deborah died, and again we're told that Israel does evil in the eyes of the Lord. And for 7 years, God gives Israel into the hands of the Midianites. And after the 7 years, finally, Israel call out to God. And God says to them, I said, do not worship the Baals, but you did. And then God comes to Gideon, with Israel having cried out to God once again. And Gideon, by his own admission, is the least in his clan, and the clan is the least in the tribe of Manasseh. And we remembered that God doesn't always choose those who are obvious. The people maybe who would seem to be the ones who are the strongest or with the best gifts. But he chooses those people who he knows will be of use to him and who will have a set of skills and talents, gifts, wisdom that can be used for him. And he said to Gideon, I will be with you, and also you will strike down all the Midianites. Gideon then had an encounter with God's angel, a messenger who came to him. And he obeys this angel who came to him, and in part of doing that, he got rid of the idols and all the things that had been built by the people to worship the idols. He comes under opposition from the townsfolk, but he builds an idol to God himself. And we remembered that an idol had to be built in the town for God. Here we were in the land of Israel, in the promised land that the people had come into, and yet they had got rid of any suggestion of God. And because God started to come and work amongst them again, they had to rebuild an idol. And it was only 7 years since Deborah had died, and in that time the land had got to such a state. It's a reminder to us just how quickly things can change, how quickly we can come under attack from Satan, how quickly we can lose our fervor for God. Gideon came under opposition from his the townsfolk in the town that he lived in, and they threatened him with death, but his father stood with him and stood beside him. And we remembered the importance of supporting each other as his father stood with him. Satan had lost this battle. Satan had the idol and the place of worship for Baal taken away. And so Satan prepared for war. He sends a massive army. If we read through the rest of Judges 6 to 8 and you do the maths, you'll see that there was 135,000 in the army that Satan sends in to fight against people of Israel. And we're going to have another reading, and we're going to read Judges chapter 6 and verse 25 to help us tonight. And this is just after Gideon has built an altar to the Lord. That same night, the Lord said to him, "Take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old, tear down your father's altar to Baal, and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on the top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering." So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. In the morning, when the men of the town got up, there was Baal's altar demolished, with the Asherah pole beside it cut down, and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, "Who did this?" When they carefully investigated, they were told, "Gideon, son of Joash, did it." The men of the town demanded of Joash, "Bring out your son, he must die, because he has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it." But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, "Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar." So that day they called Gideon Jerubbaal, saying, "Let Baal contend with him, because he broke down." Now all the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples joined forces and crossed over the Jordan and camped in the valley of Jezreel. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abiezrites, I think it is, the Abiezrites, to follow him. He sent messengers through Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so that they too went up to meet them. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said." And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. This time, make the fleece dry and the ground covered with dew." That night God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. And so Gideon goes off to war. He has this assurance from God that God is with him, and he goes off to war. We read chapter 7, verse 1. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. And there's Gideon, and he's got this army which he has gathered together. He's blown his trumpets. He's called the people from the neighbouring tribes as well to come and to fight with him. And they have 22,000 people. But God says to him, "Gideon, you've too many men." "But there's 135,000 against us, Lord." "Sorry, Lord, would you say that again? We've too many men." God explains why. He says, "Yes, if you have all these men, they'll think it was their strength that brought the victory. They'll think it was their strength that brought the victory. Doesn't God know us so well that if something happens and we've had something to do with it, we think it was ourselves, and we'll not give the glory and honour to God that he deserves? We're told that our God is a jealous God. He's jealous for himself. He's jealous for the honour of his name. He doesn't want glory to go to anyone that it doesn't deserve. He wants the glory to be given to himself. And so Gideon is told to send away all those who are afraid. And 22,000 people leave, but 10,000 remain. Boy, it's going to be hard, isn't it? Just see Gideon there walking up and down. It's over a third of my army is gone because they were afraid. Well, maybe it's as well they've gone, because maybe once the battle started to fight, they'd have just scattered, they'd have disappeared anyway. They wouldn't have been much use. But I've got 10,000 men. Lo, Gideon, it's me again. There's still too many. We're going to do a little test. We're going to see how many of the men will drink in a certain way from the stream. And God tells Gideon that he's to look and see, there's a stream nearby, and all those who lie down in their bellies and just put their head in the water and drink that way, I don't want them. Those who kneel down and picking the water up into their hands like this and lap it like a dog, they're the ones that I want. Seems a strange way to choose an army, doesn't it? And sometimes God chooses us or his people in a way that we can't really understand. It's worth thinking about. How do we choose people for certain tasks? Do we use our own understanding if we've got to start a new ministry in church, or if we're trying to reach out into the community? Who do we put in place? Do we try to use our own wisdom, or how much time do we spend in prayer and waiting before God and listening to what God says? And if he says send them all down to the front and let's see how they paddle about in the water, or take them into the woods and let's see how they climb trees, would we think, God, you're... No, that can't be God. God can't do that. But here he is. He says, see how they drink water out of the stream. Do we consult God when we're choosing people for things? But Gideon does what God asks him. And God, I imagine, says to him, good, we'll take the 300 people that are left, the 300 who lapped the water from cupped hands, with these we will defeat Midian. Get ready for the battle, and don't forget to bring the food and the trumpets. Don't forget the food. That's practical. Don't forget the trumpets, because that's how we're going to defeat Midian. So here we are, Gideon. Nearly 32,000 people have gone back home. There's 300 of them. There's 135,000 on the hillsides all around them. And the Midianites must be a bit perturbed and wondering what's going on. Gideon goes to bed, and then he hears God. Wake up, Gideon.
Now is the time to attack. Now is the time I'm going to give them into your hands. And Gideon's maybe half asleep. And he's worried about, there's only 300 of us, God. Maybe we'd thought you were going to send some other people along. And God understands our anxieties at times like this. And God says to Gideon, if you're anxious, take your servant and go and listen to what they're saying in the Midian camp. God's a great encourager. He loves us to be encouraged, to know what he's going to do. He doesn't keep us in the dark. He encourages Gideon. To Gideon, the opposition seems unbeatable. At the start of, in chapter 7, we read that the camp of Midian, the army looked to Gideon and his fellow soldiers to be as thick as locusts, and they had camels that couldn't be counted. It would have been so easy to be put off. But God was in control. And we must remember that if things seem to be impossible to us, God is in control. And so Gideon and his servant head off down to the Midianite camp. It's night time. They're able to sneak in to the camp under the cover of darkness. And they overhear a conversation. And it's a conversation about a dream that one of the Midianites had. And he tells his fellow soldier, I've had this dream. A round loaf comes rolling down into the camp with such force that it hits the tent and it overturns the tent and the tent collapses. But not God, but the Midianite says to his colleague, this must mean Gideon will triumph. How does that make Gideon feel? Is he a little more at ease to know that two soldiers have had a conversation and one of them's had this dream and he's decided that because of this dream that God's going to give victory to Gideon? How would we take that sort of information that comes to us? What does Gideon do? We're told that Gideon goes and worships his God and prepares his men for battle. Gideon heard the way they were thinking and he knew that God was in it. God had told him, if you want to be encouraged, go down and listen to what's being said. Gideon didn't say, oh, that's just the ramblings of two sleepy men. God had told him that he would be encouraged, and this is the encouragement that he gets. This is the way the Midianites are thinking. And he knew that God was going to be in it. It's worth us thinking, are we as spiritually sensitive as Gideon was? Do we hear God telling us to do something sometimes and we don't do it because we use our reason rather than our ability to follow our trust in God? Can we miss out on blessings sometimes? Can we miss out on opportunities because we're not tuned in to what God is saying? Gideon is encouraged by God. And God has given him another unlikely strategy. Not just that he's only got 300 men, but God says to him, I want you to divide the men into three companies of 100 people each. I want you to give each of them a trumpet and a torch and an empty jar. Imagine going into battle with a trumpet, a torch, and an empty jar. But that's what God has said. God is not conventional. After all, he can use us. Gideon gives his soldiers, his 300 soldiers, a lead. He says, take your lead from me, and whenever I say, blow your trumpets and shout for the Lord and Gideon. And they do it, and the plan works a treat. They blow their trumpets, they break the jars, they hold their torches in their left hand, their trumpets in their right hand, and they shout, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. They're spread around this huge encampment, 300 of them. So they're not side by side. They're dotted around where the army is, 300 of them. But the sight of these torches around the camp in the middle of the night, the noise of the trumpets, and in the confusion, all the Midianites wake up and start to fight each other. And we're told the Lord caused confusion. The Midianites attacked and killed each other. Some of them get away, and Gideon calls tribesmen from the other tribes, some of the other tribes of Israel around him, the tribes of Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, to pursue them. And Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, reclaimed the waters of the Jordan and captured two of the Midianite leaders and killed them. What a God we have. It's staggering what he did. If we take time to think about this and reflect on the power and wisdom of God, the people knew that this was of God, and a powerful enemy was utterly destroyed. And sometimes we can hear this sort of thing and it's part of a story, or we read it in the Bible and yeah, we've got that, we've taken it into our brains, but I'm going to suggest that we stop just now and that we worship God because of what he has done, and that we sing a couple of songs, and then we'll go on with the rest of the story. But the war wasn't over. Satan was still at work. In chapter 8, in the first three verses, we read that the Ephraimites have a go at Gideon, one of the tribes of Israel. They feel snubbed. Why did you not call us? Why did you call us, not call us when the battle was going on? Why did you leave it so late in the day to call us? But Gideon points out that they were the ones who actually killed the two leaders that had been captured. They'd captured two of the leaders. And Gideon, in a sense, plays to their egos and says, you know, you captured the two most important people. And it appeases them. To give you an idea of what had been happening, there's a map here. I'm not sure if you can see it particularly well, but hopefully it'll it'll help. And this is where Gideon lived, Ophrah, and this is where the battle was. And the other tribes, there's Asher and Zebulun, Manasseh, the different tribes that lived around this area. And after the battle, the army that was opposing Gideon fled down through the Jordan Valley to this area. And Gideon, we're told, and his 300 men pursue the Midianites. The 300 men still are chasing these people down through this area. And they come... Press the wrong button there. They pursue the Midianites. And they come to these two towns here, Succoth and Penuel. And these two towns, Gideon comes to them and he says, look, we're absolutely exhausted. We've been fighting this battle. Will you give us some food? We'll pay you for it. But we need some sustenance. And the two towns refuse to give them sustenance. Now these towns, I don't know. They're in the other side of the Jordan. I don't know whether they're associated with the tribes of that stayed in that side of the Jordan or not. Or whether they're others. But anyway, they refuse to give Gideon sustenance. And Gideon and his 300 men continue to pursue the last two kings and their 1,500 men. And in chapter 8 and verse 2, or verse 12, we're told that he ambushes them, routs their army, and captures the king, or the two kings. 300 men achieved all this. Whenever the two towns had refused to give Gideon sustenance, refused to feed his army, he said, I'll be coming back to you and you'll pay for it. And the first town, he said, we will strike you with briars from the desert. And in the second town, he said, there's a tower in your town, and we will pull that tower down. And true enough to his word, if we read in chapter 8, we see that that's actually what happened. Gideon punishes the towns, and the people of Succoth are punished with briars from the desert, and the tower in Penuel is pulled down, and Scripture tells us that all the men of the town died as a result of that. Gideon administers this punishment. He obtained the names of all the leading men from Succoth, and he punished them with thorns and briars as he had promised. And he pulls down the Tower of Penuel, killing all the men of the town. And then there's still the two kings that Gideon has with him, that he has taken as captive. And it gets personal for Gideon at this point. And he inquires about a massacre at a place called Tabor. And as he speaks to the two kings, he asks them, what did these men that you killed look like? And they say, they looked like you did. And he realizes that it was these kings that had killed his brothers. And as a result of that, Gideon killed the two kings, and we're told took the ornaments off the necks of their camels. when we read the Old Testament, I sometimes wonder if we read it and take on the full impact of the atrocities that happen in the Old Testament. And here is 135,000 people who are killed. And they're killed by God's people, by 300 of God's people. How do we feel about this? How do we feel about punishment, especially if it comes from God? It's not what people in our land like to think of God. We don't think of God, or at least many people don't think of God as being a God who punishes. They think of God as being, I suppose, maybe at best a benign, benevolent being. And he'll see me all right at the end. You heard people say that? When it comes to the end, he'll add up what I've done and what I haven't done, and I'll be all right. But we see that God punishes. The people that attacked Israel in God's eyes were evil. They were hindering the work of God, and they were cold-blooded murderers, and they required punishment. And they are punished. And Gideon kills the two kings. And then all the Israelites go back to their land, to their homes, and they renew their worship of God. And it seems to all be going just so well. And the people come and they say to Gideon, "Will you please come and rule over us? You're obviously a great army commander. You have the confidence of all the people. You've responded to God. You've got a relationship with him. Will you come and rule over us?" But Gideon says, "No, let the Lord rule over you. Let the Lord rule over you." What a wise thing to say. Let the Lord rule over you. It all seems to be going so well. And then we see Satan at work again. And he says this: "Each one of you, give me a gold earring from your plunder." All the men would have plundered the battlefield. They'd have gone round and taken all the ornaments, all the gold, all the swords, everything that the attacking enemies had. They would be loaded with stuff. They would have so much stuff, and they take it all. And Gideon asks just for one earring from each of the men. And the people are only too happy to do this for Gideon. And I suspect they actually gave him more than one earring from the plunder, because we're told that he received 1,700 shekels of gold, as well as ornaments, pendants, purple garments, and each chain from the neck of the camels. Is it not reasonable to reward the person who responded to God, who led the people? It was all going so well until Gideon took the gold and he made what's called an ephod, which I had to look up to see what it was. And an ephod is a richly decorated apron-like garment. So it's something that you would put on, just like an apron over you, and it would probably be something like clasps here that would hold it in place. And it was very richly decorated with all this gold that Gideon had been given. And that in itself might not have been too bad, except that Gideon took that ephod and he put it on display in his town. And when he puts it on display in his town, it's a bit like, I was thinking about this, probably what happens whenever many people go to visit cathedrals or other places like that. It became a tourist attraction. It became something which people wanted to go and visit. It was a tangible thing that they could come to, and they started to worship there. And the people worship it. And we're told at the end of chapter 8 of Judges, it became a snare to Gideon and his family. The honour that God had been so jealously guarding and making sure that he received it all by getting rid of nearly 32,000 people and leaving Gideon with an army of just 300 and giving them all the victories that they did to this 300 people is taken away from God because Gideon made this ephod and set it up in a prominent place in the land so that he could get the honour that God should have had. We need to be so careful in our lives whenever things go well for us that we don't think that it's something that has happened because of what we have done, but rather give God the honour and the glory that he deserves. Gideon lived for a further 40 years, and there was peace in the land for 40 years. There's a topic for another day that comes up at the end of Gideon's story. He had 70 sons because he had many wives and concubines. And we could think of other people in scripture, like Solomon and David, even Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, who had additional wives to the ones that God had chosen. I'm not suggesting in any way that any of us want to go out and necessarily get another wife. But isn't it interesting that through scripture, men, God uses men who disobey him in this area. I think it shows us so much of the forgiveness of God and the grace of God. And there may be other sins which God doesn't accept, doesn't tolerate, but understands. He understands us, that we are failed, fallen human beings, and he can still use us as he used Gideon, as he used Solomon, as he used David, as he used Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and others. So Gideon had 70 sons. He died, we're told, at a good age. And then the footnote to Gideon's story. No sooner had Gideon died then the Israelites prostituted themselves to the Baals. They did not remember the Lord their God who had rescued them, and they showed no loyalty to the family of Gideon. How quickly we can fall away. What happened? Why did it happen? Because the Israelites had no one in place to take over when Gideon died. There was no leadership in place that they could follow. I think it's important that we remember those in leadership in our society and in the context in which we're speaking, in our church as well, and the positions that they're in, and the pressures that they come under, and that they would have wisdom in all the things that they do. How quickly we can fall away if there is no leadership. Gideon's story is an amazing story. It truly is right that we worship God for the deliverance that he brought to Israel, the way in which he took a nation which had totally rejected God just about. The extent that there wasn't even an altar to God in their towns and villages. Baal's altars were there instead. And God won them back for himself. Is that not what he's done with each one of us? Each one of us at one point was wandering away from God. And it wasn't our doing that brought us back to God. Nothing that we could do would bring us back. It was God reaching out to us, calling to us, coming to us and helping us, instructing us, showing us, and eventually drawing us to the point where we throw down any resistance and say, "Yes, Lord, I'll follow you." Gideon's story is a story of a nation that had rejected God, but then cried out to him and he answered them. It's a story of a man who was the least of people, who was used mightily of God. It's a story of great deliverance. It ends up also as a sad story. A story of someone who did something that probably didn't have or hadn't the intention of this ephod becoming something that would be worshipped, an idol for the people. But because he wasn't sensitive, because he wasn't sure of what he was doing, it became something that it shouldn't have become. And the people let it be that way. We need to be so careful in the lives that we live for God in these days, that we question everything, that we understand what's going on around us, that we're not prepared to just go with the flow, but rather that we look to God for wisdom and help in every situation. Let's pray.